Good evening, church. I'd like to welcome everyone back this evening. To those of you who are members here, welcome. To those of you who are visiting here, welcome. Those that may be listening on the radio in the parking lot, or those of you that may be listening on YouTube, we want to extend our welcome to everyone that may be listening right now, and we hope you can be back again with us soon. I'd like to echo what Stuart said this morning, in that I am not the normal preacher here, so if you are visiting, don't cast your judgment of this place completely based on me. We have a new guy coming in, Daniel. He's going to be starting his work with us next month. I haven't heard him too much, so I can't say too much about him, but we did get to golf with him, and I'll say his patience is a little better than mine, so we're already doing a little better in that regard. And then also, if you weren't here this morning, Stuart's lesson was really, really good. If we've missed heaven, we've missed it all. And that made me think a lot about one of the people who used to go here, Charlie Christopher. He used to say it all the time. If we've missed heaven, our life has been a total failure. And isn't that so true? One of the things I've been thinking a lot about recently. With that being said, we're going to talk about something a little bit differently. If you want to get a head start, we're going to be in Exodus 17 this evening, if you want to go ahead and turn there. But the title this evening is going to be Upon This Rock. And I want to start from an even greater view this evening, rather, of what do you think of when you hear the word rock? So when I originally started building this sermon, it was for a different congregation that I was going to be able to preach at. My mom was going to come and support me there, and she said, "What are you going to be preaching on tomorrow?" And I said, "The Rock." She said, "No, you're not." So some of you may be thinking about the Rock. I don't know. That's not a picture of Matt Burns. I know everybody may be thinking that's Matt Burns. That's not Matt Burns. That is Dwayne Johnson. So if you're an entertainment fan, you may be thinking about The Rock. Some of you may be thinking about, my brother just got engaged. That's a picture that I took. I'm quite proud of it. That's why I'm sharing it. The Rock. A rock on your finger. Some of you may be thinking about Cracker Barrel. When they come over the PA system, they're like, "Party of Smith, you know, come to the hostess stand." Maybe thinking, "Do I have any geologists in the building?" Yeah, that's probably about right. That's what I expected. If we did have a geologist, you might be thinking limestone, metamorphic, something more literal. Or if you're like my dad, classic rock, you have the Eagles, you have normal rock like ZZ Top or Metallica. I don't know what it may be that you may be thinking about. But as you can see, there's lots of things in today's society that we use the word rock for. And the Bible is no exception to doing that, and tonight what I want to do is explore some of the stories in the Bible that mention a rock or a stone and see how the symbolic nature of that rock or stone in those stories can contribute to a larger importance of that story. So we're going to start in Exodus 17, as I mentioned. We're going to read the entire chapter there, probably a familiar story to most of us here. But starting in verse 1, "Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, 'Give us water that we may drink.' So Moses said to them, 'Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?' And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, 'Why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?' So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, 'What shall I do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink.' And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the contention of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, 'Is the Lord among us or not?' Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose us some men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.' So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became heavy, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called its name, the Lord is my banner. For he said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. So here in these couple of stories that we have in Exodus 17, we see these people in the wilderness, these children of Israel, rather in the wilderness, doing what they do best in the wilderness, which is doubting God. And we see that they've contended with Moses to the point of saying, why did you bring us out of Egypt just to kill us, just to kill our children, just to kill our animals? And we see that as a response, Moses goes to God. And he says, these people want to stone me. Like, can you do something for us, please? And we see that God says, you know what? Go up on the mount, strike the rock, and water will come gushing out. And what does he do? He does that very thing that God tells him to do. And he provides water for the people of Israel. And then we see in the latter half of this chapter that these Israelites are in battle with Amalek. And in verse 11, it says that when Moses holds up his hand, when he has the rod of God in his hand, that the Israelites prevail. And when not, Amalek prevails. And if you've ever held your hands up or held anything in your arms for any amount of time, you know that your shoulders can become tired pretty quickly. And that's exactly what I see happening here in verse 12. It says that Moses' hands became heavy. So what do? I find it interesting that they took a stone and sat him on a stone so that they could lift his arms. And then if we fast forward even more in the Old Testament and we go to Numbers in the 20th chapter, we see almost a carbon copy of what's happening here in Exodus 17, except for a couple of things that are different. And for time's sake, we're not going to read what's going on there. So I'll save the time and just say that the couple of differences were that instead of striking the rock, God tells Moses and Aaron to speak to the rock. And so we see that they bring the children of Israel together. And whenever they all come together, we see right before they strike the rock again, which is not what they were told to do, that they say, should we bring forth water from this rock? And I find that kind of interesting that it's more selfish in nature than the first attempt to bring water from the rock. But we see that once again, they strike the rock and water comes gushing out of it. So then, with all that being said, what exactly can the significance be behind these stories and these rocks in these stories? And we'll come back to that verse in just a second. And I think the thing that I can see in these stories is that this rock serves as a symbol of provision for God's people. In the first instance, we see that when Moses obeys, God provides water from the rock. We see in the second instance that when Moses was weak, when his arms became tired, he was placed on a stone to support him enough so that Aaron and Hur could lift his arms. And in the third instance, we see that even though they didn't fully obey God, God still provided water for his people. And I find it interesting that we can make a connection already between us and the people of Israel. If you want to turn over to 1 Corinthians in the 10th chapter, we're going to start in verse 1 there. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them. And that rock was Christ. So verse 4 says that they drank from the spiritual rock that traveled with them. And then it says that rock was Christ. And I think it's no stretch of the imagination to say that we also drink from that same spiritual rock, which is Christ. And just as the Israelites were in a vulnerable state of thirst, and we see that they were in a state of battle and weakness, we see that while we too were in a vulnerable state, Romans 5:8 says that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. When we were in a vulnerable state, when we were thirsty, spiritually thirsty, Christ was provided for us. So we can relate to this story. Our spiritual rock being Jesus Christ. And with that being said, this is probably what you originally thought of whenever you saw the sermon title, Upon This Rock. So if you want to travel with me to Matthew in the 16th chapter, we're going to read about a character that is very familiar to us and very, very relatable to myself. Matthew in the 16th chapter, starting in verse 13. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" So they said, "Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he commanded his disciples that they should tell no one that he was Jesus the Christ. So here we see that Jesus comes into this region of Caesarea Philippi. And he's asking these people, What do you know about this Son of Man, this Son of Man that I am? And there's obviously a misconception in this region about who the Son of Man is. And we know that this Son of Man that's referenced is the Son of Man in Daniel 7 that comes to build an eternal kingdom, one unlike the world has ever seen before, with a man who's going to be given authority and power. And we understand this to be Jesus. And so then, we see after that misconception that they bring up, he says, no, I don't care what they say. Who do you say, Peter, that I am? And what does Peter respond? He says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And then we see that Jesus answers with, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I say, on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." And I can't help but think about in Tuscaloosa, I think it was a couple of years ago at this point, we had a guy up here, many of you may know him, Barry Britnell. He came down and he did our Fall Focus. That's just a fancy name for a gospel meeting. I don't know why we have a fancy name for it, but that's what it is. You can see right there that those are people. This is the region of Caesarea Philippi. And this is agreed upon as the area at which this story probably happened. And I'm not sure if you can see this very well, but even if you can't see it very well, you can tell that those are some large rocks that are sitting right beside where Jesus would have made this statement. We know that Jesus did this throughout his entire ministry. He used things that were around him to further illustrate his points that he was making. And this is no exception to that. We see that he makes this statement to Peter while standing by these large rocks. And why is that important? And I think it makes the story more powerful. It makes the statement more powerful to say, that's what I'm building my church on. That statement that you just made is like the rocks that we're standing beside. They're firm. They're secure. They're stable. So Peter's confession led to that. And he wanted to emphasize that was the very cornerstone of his church. And that's a statement that not even the gates of Hades can prevail against. How powerful is that? Which leads into another thing that I think about when I think about rocks in the Bible. And this one's a little earlier in Matthew. You can turn left in your Bible just a little bit to Matthew in the 7th chapter. And we're going to read starting in verse 24. And this is a story that we've been taught growing up in our Bible classes, and I'm sure many of the kids here know it now. In verse 24 it says, "Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on the house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. And so it was when Jesus had ended these sayings that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. And I think this parable serves as a perfect illustration for what we just talked about at the end of the last passage, about building on something that's firm and secure. And to kind of imagine exactly what's happening here, I kind of have a funny illustration. So many of you know, I go to Alabama. My freshman year, I kind of went random with my roommates. I ended up with three different ones, one from San Antonio, Texas, one from, you wouldn't recognize it if I said the city, Pennsylvania, and then one from Minnesota. So kind of all over the map, right? Two up in the north. So they don't really get tornadoes up there. And many of you are very familiar with how often they occur down here. April 27th, 2011, I'm sure many of you are familiar with that day. I remember the first time that we had a tornado warning down there, though. And everyone kind of prepared all throughout the day. Even the buildings themselves have structural integrity that's built for tornadoes. There's basements built in almost every building down there. And I remember my roommate, he kind of came down to the basement later after everybody else. He had a pizza box in his hand, not concerned at all. He said, I really just don't understand why everybody emphasizes, you know, these tornado warnings so much. I don't get it. And, you know, I kind of got to talking with him a little bit about it. This is why. It was the same, I learned it was the same way with me and, you know, we don't get a lot of snow in the south. They get a lot of snow. We don't prepare for the snow like they do in the north. I don't know if you guys know that, but PSA, they prepare a little differently. But the point is, there is preparation that is occurring here. And with the correct foundation and structure, we see that whoever hears these sayings of mine, is what he says, is like a wise man who builds his house on the rock. So we see this contrast between this wise man, he's building his house on the sayings of Jesus Christ that is the rock, and so obviously there's this other guy who is a foolish man who's building his house that are not on the sayings of Christ, that are on the sand. And we see that when the storms come, the one that was built on the rock is the one that stood. And I think we see the application very, very clearly in our lives. That our foundation should be on Jesus Christ so that when the storms of life come, we too can stand in the storms of life. And I can almost picture kind of what's going on. I can almost picture what's going on in this parable when you have the guy who's building his house on the sand. He's probably looking over at the guy who's building this house on the rock. You know, why are you doing that? It's so much harder. So much easier to just build it on sand. It'll be a little quicker. But I guarantee you one thing. When the rains fell, he understood. He understood why the other man was building his house on the rock. And you know, there's a lot of times in our lives where we probably run into people that are asking us, why do you do what you do? Why do you not do what you don't do? And I think we can see the same sort of idea, that when the storms of life come, we can stand strong in those times. So our foundation of everything that we do is to build our life on Jesus Christ. And our foundation should be built on Him because we know that that foundation is firm. And then, lastly, I just want to mention a few of the Psalms that kind of talk about this idea of the rock. And so I have four that are up here. There were many more that really talked about this idea. And if you want to turn with me there, you can, but I'm going to kind of move through them quickly for the sake of time. Starting in Psalm 18, in verse 2, it says this, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength in whom I will trust, my shield and the horn of my salvation, and my stronghold." 62 and verse 2. It says, "He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved." 71 and verse 3. It says, "Be my strong refuge to which I may resort continually. You have given the commandment to save me, for you are my rock and my fortress." And then 95 and verse 1. And it says, "O come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our salvation." And I think all of these verses truly echo one song. Like I said, there were many more verses than this that talked about that same concept, but I think four is more than enough to show you that there's an idea that is ringing very consistent here. And that's that God is our rock, He's our strength, our fortress, shield, salvation, safety, and He is our protection. And while I was thinking about how can I kind of talk about this in a timely manner, there was a song that kind of came to mind that we sing down in Tuscaloosa. I don't think we really sing it much here. I think we sang it at the annual singing 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. It's called The Rock of My Heart. And the words read like this. My Lord, I need nothing beside You. Without You, I could not have stood. Your promise is my hope and my refuge, Your nearness, my strength, and my good. When I was distressed and embittered by things I could not understand, Your presence was continually with me. You always took hold of my hand. I know that Your counsel will guide me in wisdom, devotion, and love. And afterward, You'll call me to glory to dwell in Your presence above. My heart may be broken within me. My earthly strength may depart. But You are my portion forever. You are the rock of my heart. And while Brother Guy was leading that prayer a while ago, I was kind of thinking about this very song. And this is a song that has words that I think a lot of people in this congregation can hear right now, with a lot of people going through a lot of different things and realizing that through it all, God should be our rock. And so, in summary, just kind of some of the things that we have talked about. The first being that God provides for His people. We see that with Moses, He provided for him in obedience. We see that He provided for him in times of weakness, in times of battle. And even in disobedience, He still provided for him. Seems to be somewhat unconditional that He provides for His people. Second thing, just as God fulfilled Israel's thirst in those situations, so He fulfills our thirst through Christ Jesus. The third thing is our foundation should be built on Jesus Christ. He should be our chief cornerstone. And I kind of left out an illustration that I like to use when talking about this, in that when you work a puzzle, you usually get the four corner pieces first, and then you kind of build the edges around the corner pieces, and then you build the middle, right? If you don't, I always like to say you should start doing it. It's a little quicker that way. But our foundation should be built on Jesus Christ. He should be those corner pieces that we start building our life around. And nothing can prevail against that foundation, not even the gates of hell. And then lastly, God is our rock. And He is sure and He is steady in all situations of life, whatever that may be, whatever you're going through, whatever I'm going through. And I always like to say I'm 21 years old, don't have it all figured out. Maybe next year when I'm 22, I'll have it all figured out. But no, God is our rock. He's sure and He's steady. Maybe it is tonight that you haven't made God a rock. Or maybe it is that you have, and you've kind of lost sight of Him being the centrality of your life. If either of those things are the case, we pray that You would come as together we stand and as